You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Spiritual Hierarchies and the Physical World. This is Lecture 6, entitled Geocentricity and Heliocentricity in Cosmic Evolution, given on April 15, 1909, in the evening. Yesterday, we saw how events in the cosmos are brought about by the beings above us in the spiritual world. At the close of the lecture, we drew attention to an especially significant event, the war in heaven, whose battlefield extended between Jupiter and Mars. Physical science today increasingly finds planetoids in that sphere. These are the corpses left behind on that cosmic battlefield. We shall return to this event. We shall also see that this event in heaven is reflected in certain events that occurred in the Earth's development. In fact, we shall find a reflection of the war in heaven in the opening of the Bhagavad Gita. Today we shall first continue our observations by describing briefly the other beings of the spiritual hierarchies we referred to in passing yesterday. The beings that are closest to human beings as we ascend are known in Christian esotericism as angels, archangels, and prime powers, or primal beginnings. They are also known as angeloi, archangeloi, and archai. In anthroposophical terminology, the archangels are also known as fire spirits, the primal beginnings as spirits of personality. The beings between us and the spiritual beings referred to yesterday as reaching out to Jupiter, Mars, and so on, are of course more closely connected to human life on Earth. Let us first consider the angels, or angeloi. They reached their human stage during the old moon period, and are at present developed only as far as we shall be developed during our Jupiter evolution. Hence they are one stage above us. What is the task of these beings? To deal with this question, we shall have to consider the development of humanity on Earth. A human being develops from incarnation to incarnation. We can trace human evolution back through the ancient Atlantean period and the earlier Lemurian times. Human evolution, in fact, began during the ancient Lemurian era. This development, by means of successive incarnations, will continue until almost the end of earthly evolution. At that time, other forms of human development will arise. Now, you know that the eternal essence of our being, our individuality, endures from incarnation to incarnation. Most people, however, remain unconscious of having lived in a previous incarnation and do not remember what happened in a preceding embodiment. Only those who have developed a certain stage of clairvoyance are able to look back into previous incarnations. Since we cannot yet remember previous incarnations, however, what kind of continuity could exist between our incarnations if there were no being to link together our individual incarnations and guide our progressive development from one incarnation to the next? We must presume, therefore, that for every human being who cannot remember, there is a being who is a level higher than humankind and leads the individual from one incarnation to the next. We should remember that these are not the beings who order karma. They are simply guardian beings who preserve the memory of one incarnation until the next, as long as a person cannot do so. These beings are angels, or angeloi. In each incarnation, each of us is an individuality, but a being watches over us, who carries the consciousness of what has occurred in our lives from incarnation to incarnation. This explains why, at certain lower stages of initiation, a person even though he or she does not yet know of former incarnations, has the possibility of asking his or her angel. This is absolutely within the bounds of possibility for certain lower levels of initiation. It is the task of the angels, therefore, to stand watch over all the threads that an individual weaves from one incarnation to another. Now, let's consider the next group of beings, known as archangels, archangeloi, or fire spirits. These beings are not concerned with single individuals. Their task is more encompassing. They bring the life of the individual and the life of broader groups of humanity, that is, peoples, races, and so on, into harmonious order. Within earthly evolution, they have the task of bringing the individual soul into relationship with what we call folk soul and race soul. For anyone who can penetrate spiritual knowledge, folk souls and race souls are quite different from what is generally understood by these terms today, especially by the abstract modern scientist. A certain number of people live in a particular area, for example in Germany, France, or Italy. Because our physical eyes perceive human beings as only so many outer physical forms, abstract thinkers merely conceive of the folk spirit or folk soul as the abstract sum total of so many people. For them, only the individual human being is real, not the folk soul or folk spirit. But for anyone who can look into the true workings of the spiritual world, a folk soul or a folk spirit is a reality. A fire spirit or archangel manifests in a folk soul, governing the relationship between individual human beings and the whole of a people or race. Ascending one stage higher than the archangels, we come to the beings known as the spirits of personality, primal beginnings or primal powers or archai. These are still higher beings who have an even more exalted task in the interrelatedness of human affairs. Essentially, they govern all the interrelationships of the whole human species on earth. They live in such a way that from age to age, through the waves of time, they can, at a particular point in time, transform themselves and take on a different spiritual body. You are all familiar with something that for the abstract thinker of today's typical education is just an abstract idea, but is a reality for anyone who sees into spiritual reality. I mean the dreadful expression we used to refer to the Zeitgeist, footnote literally spirit of the times, end footnote. This expression refers to what constitutes the significance and mission of a given human epoch. Take, for example, the mission and significance of the first millennium following the Atlantean catastrophe. Such time spirits encompass something that goes beyond single peoples or races. The spirit of the age, the Zeitgeist, is not restricted to a particular people. Its influence goes beyond the frontiers of any particular country. The true spirit of the time, or spirit of an age, is the spirit body of an archai, primal beginning or spirit of personality. Such archai, for example, are responsible for certain human individualities appearing on the earthly scene at the appointed times. You will readily understand that earthly tasks have to be accomplished largely by earthly individualities. Certain epoch-making personalities have to appear at particular times. Utter confusion would reign in earthly evolution if it were left to chance whether, for instance, a Luther or a Charlemagne were to appear arbitrarily in one era or another. Such appearances must be conceived of within the whole of human earthly evolution. The right souls must appear at a particular epoch within the overall significance of earthly evolution, as it were. This is regulated by the spirits of personality, or archai. Beyond the archai, we find the beings mentioned yesterday, the so-called powers, or exousiae, also known as the spirits of form. Here we come to tasks that reach beyond the earth. In human development, we have distinguished the evolutionary stages of Saturn, Sun, Moon, Earth, Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan. From all that occurs within the earth itself, we have seen how everything that happens to individual human beings on earth is regulated by angels. Archangels are responsible for the relation between individuals and groups. Spirits of personality, by contrast, are responsible for human evolution as it extends from the Lemurian period to a future period when human beings will be so spiritualized that they will virtually no longer belong to the earth. But something else must be regulated too. Humanity must be guided from one planetary condition to another. There must be spiritual beings whose task during the whole of earthly evolution is to make sure that when that phase comes to an end, humanity rightly passes over into a pralaya and finds its way to the next goal, that of Jupiter. This task belongs to the powers or spirits of form, the exousiae. They are the spirits who ensure humanity's guidance from one planetary stage to another. Yesterday we characterized their tasks from above downward. Now we shall do so from below upward. So, let us acquaint ourselves with the cosmic position of these beings. In spiritual science, in what should be continued as anthroposophy today, indeed in what is known as mystery wisdom, the beings of the spiritual hierarchies have always been spoken of in the same way. Yesterday, we saw that the present Saturn represents the limit of the workings of the thrones. Jupiter represents the boundary of the activity of the dominions, and Mars is the frontier for the influence of the mites, the dunamis, or virtues. Let us now characterize how the spheres of influence of these beings are distributed spatially in our solar system. Here we touch on something that, even for those of you who are prepared to a certain extent, will seem somewhat strange, although it absolutely corresponds with the truth. In school, we learn that from very ancient times until Copernicus, a concept of the solar system existed, known as the Ptolemaic system. Footnote, Claudius Oleaginus, or Ptolemy, 2nd century AD astronomer, mathematician, and geographer of Alexandria, his title Megala Syntaxis Tes Astronomias, known as the Almagest from the title of its Arabic translation, described the Ptolemaic system of astronomy and geography based on the theory that the sun, planets, and stars revolve around the earth. End of footnote. It is said that people then believed that the earth was at the center of our solar system, as indeed it appears to ordinary visual perception, and that the planets rotated around the earth. But since Copernicus, so it is said, we know at last what human beings formerly did not, that the sun is at the center, and the planets circle around it in their respective elliptical orbits. In fact, however, and this must be made clear, if one is to present the matter correctly and honestly, according to the current understanding of that standard, the true description of what occurred is something quite different. One should rather say, until the time of Copernicus, people knew only certain forms of movement in the heavens, and according to these, calculated how our solar system might be organized. What Copernicus then did was not to take a seat, so to speak, outside of the universe, to observe how the sun was placed in the center of a circle or ellipse, and how the planets moved around it. Rather, Copernicus contrived a mathematical calculation, and this formula corresponded more closely to what one saw than the previous explanation. The Copernican world system is nothing but the result of thinking. Putting Ptolemy's view aside for the moment, let us place the sun in the middle and calculate where the planets should be in relation to it. Then let us consider whether or not this corresponds to our immediate experience. Indeed, from mere physical observation, this experiment coincides completely with our experience. various cosmic systems have been built up upon this premise, including the Kant-Laplace theory. But in the light of subsequent discoveries, we come to a position that scientifically is not quite honest. Later, as a result of purely physical observation, two planets, Uranus and Neptune, were added to the system. We shall speak of their significance for our solar system later. Indeed, in describing our solar system, one should point out that the appearance of Uranus and Neptune brings a considerable amount of confusion into the calculations. If one wishes to accept the Kant-Laplace cosmic system, it follows that Uranus and Neptune should move with their corresponding moons, just as other moons rotate around other planets. But this is not the case. Among these outermost, more recently discovered planets, we have one that behaves in a singular way. If the Kant-Laplace cosmic system were correct, we would have to imagine that after all of the planets had split off, someone turned the axis about 90 degrees, because the courses of the outermost planets are different from the other planets. Neptune and Uranus differ considerably from the remaining planets of our solar system. We shall see their situation later. For the moment, we merely want to point out that the Copernican view is the result of calculations, that it is an hypothesis, an assumption made at a time when human insight into the spiritual reality behind outer happenings had completely ebbed away. The Ptolemaic view, on the other hand, is not merely a physical system. It was derived from spiritual observation, at a time when it was still known that the planets represented the boundaries of influence of higher beings. To characterize the realms of influence of these higher beings, our planetary solar system must be drawn very differently. I will now draw this planetary system as it was made clear in the mystery schools of Zoroaster. We could equally well draw from other mysteries, but we have selected this particular system to bring out the characteristics of our solar system with its planets in relation to the spiritual beings active within it. In the Zoroastrian system, something was included that differed from our observation of the heavens. You are aware that in the course of many years, one can observe a procession of the sun, apparent or otherwise, through the zodiac. It is usually stated, and quite correctly, that beginning approximately in the 8th century B.C., the sun rose in the sign of the ram, Aries, at the spring equinox. Each year, however, the sun advanced a little further, so that in the course of long periods of time, the whole of the sign of the ram was traversed. Before 800 B.C., the sun did not rise in the ram, but in the sign of the bull, Taurus. This lasted about 2,200 years, so that the sun had traversed the whole sign of the bull with its vernal point. Before this, the sun rose in the twins, Gemini. That is, the sun rose in the twins before 800 plus approximately 2,200 years B.C. If, therefore, we look back to the 4th and 5th millennia B.C., we find the vernal point in the sign of the twins. This was the period when the mysteries of Zoroaster flourished. They flourished in the distant past, when all the appearances in the heavens were calculated in relation to the sign of the twins. So if we draw the zodiac as it was described yesterday, we would have to place the constellation of the twins here at the top. We would then have to draw what served as the boundary of the throne's sphere of activity in immediate relation to the zodiac. That is, we must draw what made up the boundary of Saturn. After that, we must delimit the sphere of activity of those spiritual beings known as the dominions, or spirits of wisdom, the outermost boundary of Jupiter. Next, we delimit the sphere of influence of the mites, or spirits of movement. This is delineated by the boundary of Mars. We have seen that the battlefield left by the war in heaven is between these two. To differentiate correctly between the various realms of power, however, we must also draw the boundary line of the sun. Just as Mars marks the outer boundary of the influence of the mites, so the orbit of the sun represents the frontier of the authority of the powers or spirits of form. Here, then, is the boundary marked out by Venus that represents the sphere of influence of the Arcai. Next we come to the realm marked out by Mercury. This is the sphere of influence of the archangels, the fire spirits. We are now coming quite close to the earth. We reach the realm of influence bounded by the moon. Therefore, here we must draw the earth. You must picture the earth as the starting point, and around it a sphere of influence reaching to the moon. This is followed by a realm reaching up to Mercury, then one to Venus, and then one to the sun. You may be astonished at the sequence of the planets as I have given it here. You might think that if the earth is here, and here the sun, you would believe I should draw Mercury here near the sun, and here Venus. This is, however, not right, because both planets were, with regard to their names, mixed up by later astronomy. What is called Mercury today was called in ancient teachings Venus, and the planet referred to as Venus today was in all the old teachings called Mercury. Mark this well. One does not understand the old writings and teachings if one applies what is said there about Venus and Mercury to what is meant today by the same names. What is said about Venus had to be applied to present-day Mercury, and what is said about Mercury to Venus, because both of these designations were mixed up later. At the time when one turned the world system around, when the earth was stripped of her central position, one not only changed the perspective, but allowed Mercury and Venus to roll around each other in relation to the old designations. Footnote for background to this complex question of the relationship of Mercury and Venus, see Appendix page 251 in this edition. Now you can reconcile what has been drawn here with the physical planetary system. Here is the sun, and Venus revolves around it. Beyond that, Mercury revolves around the sun. Then the earth with the moon, and beyond that Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn revolve. You must imagine the physical movements in a way that each planet revolves around the sun. But you can also think of an arrangement where the earth is here and the other planets have revolved so that on their paths they are behind the sun. If I wish to represent this diagrammatically, it would be as follows. First, we draw the physical system in the usual way. We place the sun at one of the focal points and let Venus, Mercury, and Earth, with its moon, rotate around it. Here are Earth, Mercury, and Venus, according to the old designation. Next is Mars. Then, after the planetoids, Jupiter, and finally Saturn. You must imagine that the Earth is here, below. Then we have Mercury, and Venus, and then Mars up there, and Jupiter, and so on. Now you have the Sun, Mercury, and the present Venus here. The planets can take up a variety of positions in relation to one another, and there is no reason why they should not stand like this. It is plausible. We have drawn the current physical system. To do so, we have chosen a particular moment when the Earth, Mercury, and Venus are situated on one side of the Sun, and the other planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, are on the other. That is all we have done, nothing more. Here are the Earth, Mercury, Venus, and on the other side of the Sun we find Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. It is simply a matter of changing perspective. This system is imaginable, but it is valid only for this particular constellation. This actually was the case at a time when the twins were above Saturn. At that time, one could clearly observe clairvoyantly the spheres of influence of the spiritual hierarchies. Around the earth, one could behold the sphere of the angels extending out to the moon. Truly, if we do not take the physical system as our basis, but this unique constellation, we then find around the earth a round of angels extending to the moon. Beyond that, the sphere of archangels extending to Mercury. Outward to Venus, the spirits of personality, finally the powers, exousiae, or spirits of form, extending to the sun. Then, as I told you yesterday, We come to the sphere of the virtues, mights, and after that the spheres of the dominions and thrones. When speaking about the Copernican and Ptolemaic systems, we must be clear that the Ptolemaic system has preserved something of the constellation of the ruling spirits, and from that perspective the Earth must be taken as the starting point. A time will come when this cosmic system will again be correct, because humanity will again know of the existence of the spiritual world. It can be hoped that human beings will then be less fanatical than our contemporaries. The modern view holds that before Copernicus, people talked nonsense and had a primitive cosmic system. But since Copernicus, we know that what is correct at last, everything else is false. Today, people more or less think that, for example, because the Copernican system is right, it will be taught into the infinite future, even after millions of years. Human beings have rarely been as superstitious as modern theoretical astronomers, and hardly ever was there such fanaticism as there is in this field. We may hope that future generations will be more tolerant, and say that humanity was no longer conscious of the spiritual world after the 15th and 16th centuries, and further, that a spiritual world does indeed exist, and that in the spiritual world one has other perspectives, and must arrange heavenly bodies other than from simple physical observation. Previously, such vantage points were useful. Then a time came when the arrangement of the heavenly bodies had to be established physically. People of the future will say it is understandable, and that after the 16th century, the physical view was also correct. For a while, humankind had to ignore anything connected with the spiritual world, but then people began to think again in terms of a spiritual world and returned to the original spiritual viewpoint. One hopes that future generations will understand that astronomical mythology, as well as other forms of mythology, was once possible, and that they will not regard our age with the same disdain that contemporary humanity, in its superstition, shows toward its ancestors. We see, therefore, that the Copernican system became a different one, because mere physical perceptions were considered. Before then, remnants of spiritual perception remained in the Ptolemaic system. But we can gain an idea of the working and weaving of spiritual beings in our cosmic and planetary system only by considering this other Ptolemaic system. Thus we are true to the spiritual context when we say that the angels have authority extending to the moon, the archangels to Mercury, the spirits of personality to Venus, the powers to the sun, and the mights to Mars. Then come the beings known as the dominions, and finally the thrones. We merely have to draw other lines in the physical system to delimit the boundaries of the spheres of influence of the various hierarchies. As far as the spiritual influences are concerned, the Earth, not the Sun, is at the center of the cosmic system. The following, therefore, was maintained by people of all periods who placed emphasis on spiritual evolution. Though the Sun is a nobler heavenly body, and beings who are superior to humankind have developed there, nevertheless, in evolution, everything depends on human beings living on Earth. Furthermore, the sun separated so that human beings could develop further in the right way. Had the sun remained united with the Earth, humankind could not have advanced at the right pace. That only became possible because the sun withdrew, together with beings who could bear very different conditions. The Earth was left to itself, so to speak, so that humanity could establish the appropriate tempo for its evolution. A cosmic system will assume this or that configuration according to its chosen starting point and perspective. If one asks where the center of our cosmic system is, viewed purely from the perspective of our physical senses, then the answer will be that the center is as found in the Copernican system. But if one inquires about the arrangement of our solar system in relation to the spheres of influence of the hierarchies, then the Earth must be at the center. In this case, we use other boundary lines, because the planets are also something entirely different in this regard. They mark out the limits of the realms of the spheres of influence of each spiritual hierarchy. You will now understand the relationship between the spatial distribution of the spheres of influence and what was said earlier about the task and mission of the various hierarchies. The beings closest to the Earth, who are active in its immediate vicinity as far as the moon, are the angels. From this realm they guide the lives of individual human beings from incarnation to incarnation. But more is required to distribute the masses of people appropriately, to allot their tasks on Earth. A simple reflection will show that here cooperation with the cosmos is necessary. Whether a group of people is endowed with this or that in its character does not depend on earthly, but on the cosmic context. Consider how the conditions of skin and hair in one race is different from those of another race. Cosmic conditions, which must be ordered out of heavenly space, affect these characteristics. That occurs out of a sphere of influence reaching to Mercury, in other words, to the boundary of the influence of the archangels. The guidance of the whole of earthly human evolution is effected from more distant heavenly spaces, extending as far as Venus. When the task of the Earth itself needs to be directed and guided, this proceeds from the very center of the whole system. Humanity develops through Saturn, Sun, Moon, Earth, Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan. The powers, or the spirits of form, are the beings of the spiritual hierarchy who direct the mission of humanity from one planet to the next. They must operate from a specially selected position. Their sphere of influence extends as far as the Sun. The Sun was already a special body when it was next to the ancient Moon. The Sun is now again in close proximity to the Earth. In the future, it will be near Jupiter. Its realm of influence extends beyond that of the individual planets. Therefore, the existence of the Sun is connected with those spiritual beings whose sphere of influence goes beyond that of individual planets. The Sun is an extraordinary heavenly body toward which each sphere of influence reaches, and whose own sphere of influence reaches beyond those of the individual planets. This is to say that we find the external dwelling place of the hierarchies, their external sphere in space, not so much on the individual planets, as within the orbits marked out by the planets as if they were boundaries. Imagine an entire sphere surrounding the Earth extending to the Moon. This space is filled with angelic activity, while the sphere from the Earth to Mercury is likewise filled with the workings of the archangels, and so on. Thus we are concerned with spheres in space, and the planets mark the boundaries of these realms of activity of higher beings. We find a continual progression of perfection from humankind outward. As human beings, we are chained to the Earth, but our eternal part that passes from incarnation to incarnation is guided by beings not bound to the Earth, but who traverse the air sphere and what lies beyond, extending to the Moon and so on. Humanity has been developing on Earth since primeval times. Earthly human development is similar to the relationship between the small child and the mature adult. The adult teaches the child. The same is true of the hierarchies and the cosmic totality. Human beings bound to the Earth can struggle through to the knowledge needed for their necessary destinies on Earth only gradually. They must be taught by higher beings. But what must happen for this goal to be achieved? In the early phases of the Earth existence, beings not ordinarily bound to the Earth had to descend from higher spheres. This actually occurred. Beings who needed only to live in the sphere surrounding the Earth descended to impart to humanity what they already knew as older, more perfect members of the hierarchies. They did not have to incarnate into human bodies for their own evolution. They did not need that. Similarly, when adults teach children, they do not spend time with the alphabet for their own progress. It is to teach the child. So we look back at Atlantean and Lemurian times when beings descend out of the sphere around the earth, incarnate into human bodies, and become teachers of humanity. These are beings belonging to the higher hierarchies of Mercury and Venus. Children of Venus and Mercury descended and became the teachers of a youthful humankind. Thus, within this youthful human species, in its early stage of development, there were human beings who represented Maya in their sojourn on Earth. Truly such beings existed. Let us suppose, in order to characterize it more clearly, that a normally developed Lemurian human being had met such a being. Outwardly, this being did not appear particularly different from other human beings. But a spirit dwelt in that body, whose realm reached up to Mercury or Venus. Thus the outer appearance of such a human being represented Maya, an illusion. This being looked like other human beings, but was something entirely different, a child of Mercury or Venus. This phenomenon occurred throughout the dawn of human evolution. The children of Mercury and Venus descended and sojourned among human beings, so that they also had, in an inner way, the character that the Mercury and Venus beings have. These Venus beings are spirits of personality. Such beings wandered on the earth as human beings, who were narrowly limited human personalities externally, but guided humanity through their enormous power. Those were the forceful, guiding relationships of the Lemurian time, when the children of Venus piloted the entire human species. The children of Mercury led portions of humanity, and were as powerful as what we call today the race or folk spirits. Maya, or illusion, is not just in the world generally, but also in relation to human beings. People who stand before us can appear so that their appearance is true, so that what is external corresponds precisely to their souls, or it could be Maya. Then the person has a task that corresponds to the task of a child of Mercury or Venus. This is what is meant by saying that the leading individuals of ancient times, as they walked the earth with their ordinary names, fundamentally represented Maya. That is what H. P. Blavatsky meant when she indicated that the Buddhas represented a Maya. You can find this expression entitled The Secret Doctrine. Such things are derived from the teachings of the Holy Mysteries. We need only understand them correctly. We must now raise the question, how does it come about that a child of Venus descends to Earth? How can a bodhisattva live on Earth? The being of a bodhisattva, the being of a child of Mercury or Venus, forms an important chapter in the evolution of our Earth in relation to the cosmos itself. Tomorrow, therefore, we shall consider the nature of the children of Mercury and Venus, of the bodhisattvas or dhyana buddhas. The end of Lecture 6.